speaker is Dr. Mangan, and he'll be talking about opportunities for farmers in the United States to grow tropical vegetables. And he'll share us some his own experiences, his efforts in doing so. Dr. Mangan, we are thankful to you for you.
Thank you. Yeah, so this will be a little different. I was thinking, I'm going to talk about one of the cities in Massachusetts, Worcester. We got the most snow of any city in the United States over this past winter, and I'm going to talk about tropical stuff. So, but we have about 30,000 acres of vegetables in Massachusetts. 70% of that acreage is with crops from the tropics, and it's about $600 million in retail sales. I say retail sales because a lot of our produce is sold retail. So, I do a lot of work with immigrant markets, and we're a country of immigrants. This is we have the largest Portuguese-speaking population in the country in Massachusetts, made up of Portuguese. We still have a lot of Portuguese, mainly from the Azores. And this is a festival in Saugus. And, you know, what happens when these immigrants come, and we have a lot of immigrants here, they bring language, culture, and the desire for their food. They want their food. With the Portuguese, collards. If you want to find Portuguese, look for the collards. Collards is a staple in Portugal and also in other Portuguese-speaking countries. As the Portuguese were colonizing, they brought collards with them. And that's why feijoada, which is the national dish of Brazil, comes with collards. You know, I always thought of the immigrant populations coming in the dominant immigrant populations in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And as a percentage of the total country, it was. But in terms of actual numbers, it's just continuing to grow. And the big difference is that unlike, you know, since the beginning of our country, except, well, we had slavery, of course, but most of the immigrants that were coming on their own volition were coming from Europe. They were coming from temperate regions. And what's happened, you know, starting in the 60s, but certainly the majority of immigrants coming now are coming from tropical regions. And so they, again, are bringing desires for things that are part of their culture. The other thing in my experience is that we had a project, USAID project in El Salvador. And this is one of the farms that we worked with. And a lot of the immigrants from Latin America, they're coming from poor, rural areas. When I talk with people in the major cities of these countries and I talk about the foods that these people want, sometimes they don't even know what it is. And why are you even growing that? We're growing that because that's where the majority of the people are coming from, and that these are the crops that they want. So I've used this picture before. I like this picture because it shows probably the most exaggerated example of the desire for crops that are popular with these groups. And if there's time at the end, I'll show a quick video. So these are three crops. Actually, there's a fourth crop, a type of squash, popular with Brazilians. We have the largest Brazilian population in the country in Massachusetts, mainly because we have a lot of Portuguese. The Portuguese hire the Brazilians. Basically. So these are three crops, never been grown in Massachusetts before, and all very tropical, especially the middle one. And these are students. I have there's one woman from the Azores and then some students from Brazil. All my graduate students are from Spanish or Portuguese-speaking countries because we focus on those communities. So these are crops in the tropics. This was an event at a supermarket in Massachusetts. And then we started the event, and these are all the Brazilians that came, and they're going after the leafy green, which is called taioba. It was an absolute madhouse. And this is the produce manager who's telling them one bunch per person, because they would take it by the pallet if we had it. And so 100 pounds in 15 minutes, and it was $6 a pound. And that's still the price for that taioba. The wholesale price is $4 a pound, and the retail price, actually the retail price can be higher than that. So this just didn't happen. So this is, you know, kind of the work that we've been doing. The other thing we're always doing, we're doing surveys all the time. You know, Brazil is a huge country, 200 million people. It's twice the population of Mexico, and extreme differences in culture and in cuisine. This taioba is fairly specific to the central east part of Brazil, Minas Gerais and Goiás. Actually, the PhD student I have from Brazil that worked on that, she never heard of it before. She's from Maranhão. And so Minas Gerais, there's a dominance of people from Minas Gerais. So we're all in the, it's the same thing for Mexico. One of the crops I'm going to show is extremely popular in the southern part of Mexico. People in Mexico City have never heard of it before. So this is, you know, I teach vegetable crops, and this is a vegetable. It's an aroid. Xanthosoma sagittifolium, it's grown mostly for its corm, which is, we call it in English tanya, but it's very popular, especially with people in the Caribbean, called malango yautia, and a lot of it is found in our markets. But this particular variety or type is grown for its leaves. They don't harvest the corms from this. And so that's in Brazil. That's actually one of my graduate students. She did her master's on mashishi. But this is she grew up on a coffee farm in Minas Gerais. And it's kind of like a weed there. But here it is in Martha's Vineyard. Martha's Vineyard, 20 years ago, there were a lot of undocumented Irish. Now there's a lot of undocumented Brazilians there. There's like 3,000 in Martha's Vineyard. And it grows very well. And that's a much cooler climate than Western Massachusetts, where I am. So it grows very well in our climate. We can't grow the corm. We can't get the corm needs 7, 8, 9 months of frost-free period. But the leaves grow very well. So we initiated a project. We work with a university in Brazil, in the state of Minas Gerais. Several of my students have come from that university. And also we got sources of the corm, so the corms, botanically the corms, the roots. And this is my student that did a PhD on this from, she got her master's at Viçosa. And so we basically are using transplants, and we put them on plastic and drip like we do everything. And plastic and drip has become more and more common in our state. And we get, we grow them as an annual. In Brazil, it would be a perennial. We harvest every other week. So the field, the part on the left, that was harvested, and this will be harvested the next week. And every 2 weeks we can harvest. So we get about 10,000 pounds per acre of leaves. The wholesale price is $4 a pound. The retail price is what it is. Usually it's around $6. The issues that we're dealing with are the cost of the corn production. We're importing the corns from Brazil. We've tried, we've contacted some tissue culture companies. It's going to be too expensive because when they're growing the ornamentals, you know, the small plant might be $2 or $3, and that's not viable for a farm. So we have a project in the Dominican Republic and going to work with them to see if they can produce the corms at a lower price and bring them to us, and then we can grow them. And we have some disease issues with Rhizoctonia and Pythium, Rhizoctonia solani and Pythium, which are common diseases in the soil, but they're really not much of a problem unless a vegetable crop is weak in some way. But they're a problem here. So, and Whole Foods, we do a lot of work with Whole Foods. We have 15 or 20 stores in the Northeast, and their regional distribution center is in Connecticut, and they're very interested in things that are different. And we have certified organic land at our research farm, and we do a lot of marketing as part of our research, and they were selling it at $7 a pound. And Whole Foods has this thing called an Andy score. It's nutrient density. I think they're kind of getting away from it, but Tioba is known to have very high nutrient density. I don't want to measure it, because if it doesn't, I don't want to tell them that. I just suggest that literature suggests that it is. So this was another one. So this is an eggplant. It's a different species than a traditional European eggplant. It's very bitter. This one is not a good market for the non-Brazilian market. It's very bitter. But that kind of like the bitter melon. But that's what people want it for. And again, we get this kind of response. This woman hadn't seen it in 15 years. And she just, you know, and it's just... you know, if we show the video, there's a word that they use in Portuguese called saudade. It's a longing. It's something from home, and you know, we capitalize on that. And so we do the things like variety trials. So this is a variety trial we did. There's two different types. One is called Morro Redondo. The other one's Comprido Verde Claro. They both grow well in our climate, and we compared them to traditional eggplant and some other ethnic ones, like zebras, popular in the Caribbean, and Kermit is a Thai eggplant. But you know, we make sure that it's viable in our climate. I got up this morning and came out. You know, I was here early, and it was hot and humid this morning, just like it is in Massachusetts now. We're in the 90s with 80% humidity. And we work, then there's always a marketing component and a promotional component to this, and this is one of the supermarkets we work with that is, they have to put it in these, because it doesn't have a PLU number, because it's something kind of unusual, so they have to put the price on it. At this stage, there's no PLU for it. And so this is the part that I'm very interested in, and it was mentioned a little bit earlier, but the whole idea of breeding and looking at, there was a very interesting article in Crop Science in June about breeding projects relevant to our region. And so this is, in the middle is a postdoc with me from Lavras, which is another university in Brazil. I met her advisor several years ago, and we made a connection. So he's been doing hybrids of Gillot. And so she's come and she's evaluating these hybrids in our climate. And so this is an example right here. Does this work? Oh, it's like that. Okay, so this is the variety that we're using, Comprido Verde Claro. It's an open pollinated that we got from a company in Brazil called Topseed. And it's still the one that's being made available. There was no fruit on this. This picture is actually taken yesterday. We had a field day. So we went through and took the borders. And look at some of the hybrid varieties. So she has 10 hybrid varieties. These two over here, these are they're called Mojandondo. It's a darker green round one. And these are the Comprido Verde Claro. But these are much, much earlier. Now this one is Comprido Verde Claro, and I'll show that in a second. We have a high tunnel. So that's something else that is becoming very common in our region, is using high tunnels to get a jump on the season. But, you know, with some of these crops that I'm mentioning, there's none of this work going on. There's no breeding. In fact, seed sources sometimes are extremely difficult. This is the high tunnel I mentioned, which is becoming very common in our region. When we say high tunnel, it means an unheated greenhouse. If we call it an unheated greenhouse, we get taxed. So we call it a high tunnel. But that's the Comprido Verde Claro, and it's twice the size of the one that's outside. And so no heat. We put down the sides when it's cold, and we get earlier yields and much higher yields. And this is my globalization picture. So Waltham butternut, which is our traditional butternut in the Northeast, it was developed at the Waltham Field Station in Massachusetts, and it's now being grown in Honduras. The irony is that the breeder that produced this 50 years ago went to Central America to get genetic material. Brought the genetic material back to Massachusetts, did crosses. So, you know, it's kind of both. But we do a lot of work with a lot of different squashes, and these are completely tropical. These are all from tropical and subtropical regions of the Americas. And these are all, in Portuguese the word is abóbora, these are all squashes popular in Brazil. This is the most common. In Portuguese they call it abóbora japonesa. This is the most common squash. It's an interesting story. It was actually brought by the Japanese from material that they got from Brazil. But one of the reasons they like this is because it has a great post-harvest. It lasts a very long time, more than any other squash. And in fact, we grow many squashes in Massachusetts, and this will last longer than anything we grow. And it's very popular. This is at a market we work with in New Jersey. New Jersey also has a large Brazilian population, and they're getting twice the retail price because of our promotion and our marketing. And the other interesting thing, so for us, hard squash is a fall thing. For them, it's year-round. For all these, I mean, it's a staple in the Caribbean, where they call it calabaza. But it's a staple in Brazil. They eat it year-round. So, and that's a nice thing about this, that this will last. We'll get a good 4 or 5 months of storage out of this. This is another type in Puerto Rico and In Cuba, they call it calabaza. In the Dominican Republic, they call it auyama. Our dominant Latinos, which I'll get to in a little bit, are Puerto Rican and Dominican. We do have others, but Puerto Rican and Dominicans dominate. And this is a staple variety. Actually, it came out of Don Maynard's program at University of Florida and Linda Beaver at the University of Puerto Rico. And we've been growing that and promoting it. And this is at our terminal market. It's called Chelsea Market. And this is one of the vendors that we work with. And one thing that's happening is that this, and we know this because we're in the market, so the demand is falling for this traditional variety, even though that's a hybrid, for kabochas. So kabocha is now, in our markets that cater to Puerto Ricans and Dominicans, kabochas far and away dominate. Washington Heights, it's a part of Manhattan. It has the largest Dominican population in the country. I visited 12 stores, and I saw calabaza, what they call auyama, once in one store. Every other store had that. It's compact. It's small. It's in a bushel and a ninth. It's not in a 50-pound bag. It's sweet. It's got orange flesh. Now, what this is Willie. What Willie is doing, he's also selling the abóbora, the Brazilian squash, as an auyama because of its good taste and also its long shelf life. That's the kabocha. So we grow more kabocha now. And it's funny, it's being also grown in the Dominican Republic. They don't eat it well. They might now. I would never see that in the Dominican Republic, but they're growing it for our markets. So this is another crop. Also completely tropical, the center of origin is Central America. And this one is a little bit different, a little more funky. This is popular in El Salvador, Guatemala, and southern Mexico, period. I don't see it anywhere else. And in fact, if you're in Mexico City and you ask about chipolín, they won't know what you're talking about. But in southern Mexico, it's a staple. So I saw this at the Center, which is their version of ARS in El Salvador, fresh. This is actually at the terminal market called La Tiendona. And they said, the researchers said, it's just that, you know, it's kind of like a, it's not a big deal. It's kind of like popular. It's almost like a weed. So I came back and I went into our markets in Massachusetts and I saw frozen chipolín in all the markets that cater to these populations. And the people would say, when I said, well, do you ever want it fresh? Well, we can never get it fresh. We want it fresh. We don't want it frozen. And just along those lines, sometimes certain crops, they do want fresh. But like okra, I had a student did his master's on okra. Okra is a staple in Brazil. And the Brazilians are fine with frozen okra. And the fresh okra that we produced, we didn't get the sales that we wanted. But with chipolín, they clearly prefer fresh. So again, this is at our research farm. We do the same thing. You know, we've already documented that it grows in our climate, and now we need to get a sense of the market. And we also want to set the price. So we grow it in bulk, black plastic and drip. I mean, everything. You know, we need to make it as close as to our normal production. And one of the things we found is potato leafhopper was a real problem. It attacks potatoes, but also all legumes, and this is a legume. And this is not a species that we have in Massachusetts, and so then it gets difficult in terms of pest management. So we got the okay to use a pesticide called Pyganic, because on its label it says leguminous vegetables, and this is a legume. But it's terrible. It's $500 a gallon and it doesn't work, but we use it to knock them down. But then we use row cover. And so this is how we grow it. Minnesota farmers, well, some farmers are spraying other stuff. We're not a regulatory agency, thank God. But we do this to protect it from the leafhopper. Now we do get the advantage of heat, but it's mainly for the leafhopper. And then we have to take it off, and then we harvest it, and then we put it back on. So it's never been grown in our region before. So we have to establish how to, you know, and no information on post-harvest, no information on fertility, no information on pest management. So we have to figure all that out, and that's what the graduate students I have that do that. So we decide the box, that we use a bushel and a ninth, And then this is the first time we brought it into a market. This was 4 or 5 years ago. $5.99 a pound. And so my guess is the estimated market in the northeastern U.S. is 60,000 pounds a week. Because we have about 200,000 Salvadorans and Guatemalans in Massachusetts. There's another 500,000, just Salvadorans in New York. There's another 500,000 in Washington, D.C. So it's a very significant market. My wife and I went to Oaxaca, which is in southern Mexico, last year, and I'd already heard about chipolín in southern Mexico. This is what they call chapil, which I always thought was the same, and it's not. It's a different species. The chipolín that we're using is Crotalaria langrostata, and that one is a different species, and there's some debate about it. But it's very different than ours, the one that we're growing, which is from El Salvador. So again, this is, you know, these kind of non-traditional crops. There's a lot of not very good information about it. So right now, we bring in seed through APHIS, but we need to create a source of our own seed, and we're working on that right now. And that's the seed of the what they call chipil there, which is not the same as we have. And the seed that we bring in, it might be 5%, might be 10%, might be 15%. It's awful. So we're working on that. So I'm going to bring you to the city with the highest snowfall in last winter. So we got a hatch project. I'm working with colleagues in the Department of Nutrition and Worcester. Worcester is the second largest city in New England after Boston. And like many urban cities throughout the urban areas throughout the United States, certainly in our region, it's becoming more and more ethnic. So we're actually taking data. We're measuring the fruits and vegetables, fresh, frozen, and canned, in different categories of markets. This is a bodega, a small corner store. But we're doing that at farmers markets, independent chain stores, traditional chain stores, the school, restaurants. And, you know, lo and behold, and this shouldn't be a surprise, in the corner markets, there's much more frozen and canned. But, you know, the frozen and canned is much cheaper. And there's a lot of research showing that, and depending on which fruit and vegetable is canned or frozen, it can actually be more nutritious. So we're working with low-income communities, and they go into these places and they have frozen and canned. They want fresh, but, you know, it can also be more expensive. So this is the name of our Hatch project. It's integrating urban agriculture and nutrition promotion to increase the consumption of fruits and vegetables, focused on Worcester, Massachusetts. And just as an aside, it's not just because Worcester is the second largest city. The federal representative of Worcester is also on the agricultural subcommittee. So that certainly entered into my reason to do that. And this just blows me away. I mean, 40 years ago, Worcester was 99.5% white. 40 years ago. Now the school system, the public school system, the largest ethnicity are Latinos, 38%, followed by non-Hispanic whites, 36%, African Americans, 14%, which includes a lot of people from Africa, born in Africa, and then Asians at 8%. So, you know, so it's tailor-made to the work that we do. So this is Aji Dulce. This is another example. I actually introduced this to farmers in our region about 15 years ago. It's a staple in something called sofrito. I'll mention that in a second. This is a sweet pepper. It's the same genus and species as habanero, but it's sweet. At least it's supposed to be sweet. Unfortunately, there's been some contamination in the germplasm. So every once in a while, you'll get one that'll be hot. Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, and Cubans, they do not use hot peppers. It's not a part of their normal cuisine. And it grows well in our climate. I mean, it's a pepper. We grow a lot of peppers. This is how it comes in usually. Dominican Republic grows a lot of it, Costa Rica. Not so much Puerto Rico because their costs are so high. So there's no breeding program on Aji Dulce. There was one at the University of Puerto Rico in Mayagüez, and it got infected by habanero. And so that was not pretty. So we go into the market. This is a market in Holyoke. And we go through them, and we look for genotypes that we think would be good, and we taste them. And then if they don't, not really hot, we take the seed. But what a great crop to have, you know, a breeding program to create a line that we know what we're going to get. You know, it's not a big deal in the Dominican Republic if they get, you know, 50% reduction in yield. I mean, it would be bad, but it wouldn't be devastating because they can grow it for 7, 8, 9, 10 months. It's really bad. We need, you know, good seeds to make sure that we're going to get good yields for our very expensive production. And this is one of the farmers that, again, went into a market, got seed, and this is Aji Dulce. I actually took this picture the other day at a farmer working outside of Worcester, so it's coming in, and I tasted like 10 of them, and one of them was hot, not real hot, but hot, and the others were all sweet. So a breeding program would be great for some of these niche crops. So this is sofrito. You'll see it in any market that caters to people from the, in particular, the Caribbean. There's sofrito and recaito. Sofrito sometimes will have tomatoes. So this is where the nutrition part comes in. So I could take a picture of the Spanish. The English was not. So anyway, there's 42 ingredients. And salt is listed twice. I think they did that so it wouldn't be listed first. But salt is listed twice. And 42 ingredients. Now we worked with our nutrition educators, and this is a very acceptable traditional recipe of sofrito. It's got what, 6 ingredients. It's got onions, Cuban bell peppers, also called Italian frying peppers, Aji Dulce, which I showed, garlic, cilantro, and then recao is a wide leaf cilantro. All of them grow in our region except the recao. We can grow the culantro or recao. It's not the easiest to grow, but no salt, no oil, you know, none of that. And my wife and I actually, we use it in everything. And you make it. We make it in a big batch, and then we freeze it, and then we take it out when we need it. But so this will be the example of what we're going to try and do to get the community to use more healthy. So we want them to continue using their diet, but we do things to their recipes that make them culturally appropriate, but use 37 less ingredients. So I'll end with this. So now this is with the African market. There's a very large Ghanaian population, Liberian population, and some others from West Africa. And what was interesting is they share a lot of the same products that are popular in Brazil. So these are two of my people. That's Dr. Marchese on the left, and Zoya Bajos is working with. They're both Brazilian. And this is Peter Barton. He's the owner of a store in Worcester. And he's got three crops that can be grown locally that he wants to get. On the left is garden egg. In the middle, they call it contumere. It's taioba. And on the right is cassava leaf. And we're growing all of them. So this is cassava leaf. Now, Liberians eat this daily. They make a soup from the leaves. They call it cassava leaf soup. And they're getting it from the Dominican Republic, which is probably growing cassava also for export. I mean, cassava, the root is huge. So I got cassava sticks from, what's it called, Echo? It's here in Florida. Echo? Yeah. So I got like 20 of them, and we just started them in our greenhouse, and here they are in our high tunnel, and they're like 6 feet high. So we get very good vegetative growth. We'll never get the roots. We just, you know, nor would I want to produce the roots. The roots are cheap. There's no way we're going to compete. So we figured, so these are the fresh leaves. We figured that they wanted the fresh leaves. They don't. They want them frozen. They said if they're fresh, after a while, they'll sour. So it's kind of strange. So we harvest them fresh. We grind them the way they want it. And then we froze it. And so that what Zariah is pointing to is our cassava. And the other one is what he's importing, and he liked ours better. He said it was greener. So we're going to look at this as a potential crop. And, you know, we have to do it on a small small scale and see the viability of it. And then this is garden egg. It's Gillot. It's Solanum Gillot. It's the same. I mean, you know, 40% of all the slaves that went to the Americas went to Africa, and they brought a lot of stuff with them, eggplant being one of them. And so we added this to the trial that Dr. Marchese did, and there's the garden egg right there. So it looks exactly like Gillot, and it's bitter. They want it bitter. They don't want white eggplant that is sweet, and people bring white eggplant to them that's sweet. They want it bitter. Maybe it's good for diabetes. I don't know. So we're going to be growing that. There's a good market for it. And then here's what they call contumere. It's taioba. It's Xanthosoma sagittifolium. It's the same that the Brazilians use. And the market for that is even bigger than the garden egg. And they don't want it canned. They want it fresh. So that's taioba that we grew, what they call contumere, for that market. So all the more emphasis, I really want to do more work with that that crop. We just need some, we need a source of corms, and we need some, you know, pathology. How are we doing on time? Time for, okay. I'm going to show a video, which is how this happened. So this video will explain this, and it has a lot to do with the work that we do. We're really involved with the community, and we use a lot of language and culture. So this is on. So you're going to listen. You're going to hear some Portuguese. 30 seconds, and I want you to listen to UMass, University of Massachusetts, Viçosa, and Saudade. Listen for those three words. All right.
Você está com saudade da verdadeira comida brasileira. Agora você pode contar. Giló, taioba, maxixe, abóbora japonesa, tudo isso fresquinho, produzido aqui em Massachusetts, com sementes do Brasil, direto para você.
Você encontra todos os produtos
no taioba, maxixe, giló, abóbora.
Esse é um projeto da UMass, com a Universidade de Viçosa, que é a da Minas. Para maiores informações, entre em contato conosco.
So we... This is kind of like Univision, and we advertise on Univision, but this is, I wanted to do this because it's, you know, it's a little different. We got 500 calls at that number in a day, 500 calls. This is Rede Global, which is the dominant TV station in Brazil, and they have a foreign one. And every Brazilian gets Rede Global. And we worked with a chain store called Seabras. And there's 14 stores. They have in New England, New Jersey, and they had one, and it's still there in Florida. And when we grow these crops, we go through their. They have a distribution system. So the taioba, the maxixe, the gillot, it all goes through to those stores, and we tell them you can get it there. But if you want more information, call. So they called, and we told them about that event, and that's what got all those people to go there. So that's it.